I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring...
Welcome to Off Kilter, the show about poverty, inequality, and everything they intersect with, powered by the Center for American Progress Action Fund. I'm Rebecca Vallis. This week on Off Kilter, with a farm bill deal on the horizon, I bring back Joel Berg of Hunger Free America for an update on the nutrition assistance front and a melodious send-off to soon-to-be former Speaker Paul Ryan, who's yet again garnering all kinds of undeserved praise as a supposed poverty warrior as news outlets mischaracterize his legacy in droves. Next, Opportunity Zones, innovative strategy for funneling private investment into distressed communities, or giant tax loophole for wealthy corporations and investors. I sit down with Benga Ajalore and Rajani Frederick, two experts on Opportunity Zones at the Center for American Progress, to get the skinny. But first, Jeremy Slevin, the Slevinator. Hi, Jeremy.
Hello.
Hello. I'm sorry. I have to say it's a nice sweater,
Thank you.
Because
yeah,
it
yeah.
is.
Well, how else are we going to start the episode?
I mean, if you hadn't been wearing a sweater, sometimes I'm out of options.
Yeah.
And I have to come up with, like, you know.
We can't put out the show.
Right. And then I have to come up with a substantive topic. And
right.
That's just, like, really, really hard to do with the, you know, time we tape in the evenings. I just checked off one of your boxes,
by
the way.
I won't say what day it is.
Thank you, Will, for taking a picture of this week's sweater. But, Jeremy, it's not just your sweater I want to talk about. It's a friggin' bad week for tomorrow. Democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's where we really need to start. And obviously, a lot of attention right now, although not nearly enough relative to what is happening, but being paid to Wisconsin and a massive, massive sour grapes Republican power grab in the wake of an election that didn't make the Republican Party in that state particularly happy. What do we know right now?
Yeah. So the Wisconsin State Senate today voted to restrict the incoming governor and attorney general's power, both of whom are Democrats, both of whom recently defeated Republicans, of course. And this is the attempt, essentially, by the state's Republicans to rewrite the state's laws because they lost. And it will have a particular impact on low-income people. It will essentially require the governor to implement the state's Medicaid waiver and require the state to stay on a lawsuit as part of the against the Affordable Care Act's protections of pre-existing conditions. Both of these were huge topics in the campaign. It's not like they're just doing this as an aside. This was literally the subject of the gubernatorial campaign and what the governor, Tony Evers, ran on. They would also require the governor to seek approval for basically any new policy regarding Medicaid or food assistance, including seeking federal approval, and basically block the new governor's flexibility in federal food programs like summer feeding or food share, which is Wisconsin's SNAP program. And of course, it's not just the low-income provisions. It's restricting early voting in the state to undermine the state's democracy. It's allowing the legislature to hire private lawyers to undermine the role, historical role, of the attorney general in the state. It is a massive, massive deal. And it's this is not the first state where it's happened, of course.
And you mentioned the Medicaid piece. I feel like one of the things that's not getting nearly enough attention within the context of this massive, far-reaching power grab is the healthcare piece of this, right? So to be very clear, the incoming governor, Tony Evers, has stated in the campaign his opposition to taking Medicaid away from jobless folks, right? Something that we also know a majority the American people don't want to see happen. And yet, that is what this legislation will require him to do, despite his having campaigned against it and the people of the state agreeing with him by putting him in that seat. He doesn't get to make that choice. And you mentioned on the Affordable Care Act side as well, locking the state leadership into that lawsuit that attorneys general are continuing to mount that would effectively gut the Affordable Care Act, specifically protections for pre-existing conditions. So just a ton in this package that's actually specifically targeting low-income Wisconsin folks as democracy gets subverted in this wholesale way. And it's not just Wisconsin where we're seeing something like this happen. We talked extensively last week about Michigan, and now we've got updates on that front as well, and they're not a hell of a lot rosier.
Right. Similar attempts. The Republican legislature in Michigan is aiming to basically limit the authority of Governor-elect Gretchen Whitmer, a Democrat, and the state's attorney general, and the Secretary of State on campaign finance laws and other legal issues, all three of whom are women, a historical first for Michigan, and now they're having essentially the rug pulled out from under their power in the state.
And the rug pulled out from under the voters who made those decisions. And I sort of feel the need to take a step back here and just point out, as much as we're walking through specific provisions here, the big picture here is Republicans in these states weren't happy with the outcome of the elections. The voters decided, they made their choices known, and now Republicans are using lame duck sessions to effectively undercut the decisions the voters made at the ballot box and neuter the position that now are going to be held by the opposing party. That's not how democracy works. Right. Does this basically make the case for doing away with lame duck sessions? Is that where we need to go here? I mean, the democracy is actually basically at a crossroads if this becomes the playbook when one party doesn't like the outcome of an election.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right to broaden it out, and it happened in North Carolina and in 2016. And I think we talk a lot about Trump's threat to democracy and his subversion of democratic norms and what that means. But I think what we're seeing is, A, it's not just Trump. This is where the Republican Party is currently at. They are an anti-small-d democratic party. They will subvert democracy to reach their ends. Regardless of what you think about those ends, they are plainly anti-democratic. And we talk a lot about how Trump is defying norms and the party is defying norms in many ways, but we're seeing that they're willing to put those norm-defying actions into law so that they are changing the law to subvert democracy long term. So I think there's a lot of potential solutions. Doing away with lame duck sessions is one, but there needs to be a similarly strong effort on the other side to protect democracy when it's under threat.
And I mean, you described a little bit of what's going on in Michigan. We also talked a lot about it, as I said, last week. Some of that is still playing out as we speak, but we're watching not just power being taken away from incoming leaders, but also we're watching actual choices that voters made at the ballot box on issues like paid sick leave, like minimum wage, also being stripped away from them so that instead of being able to make choices at the ballot box, the legislature is taking this exceptional and bizarre step of passing, and I should say Republicans in the legislature, of passing the bills that they then are now turning around. And what's happening this week is they're actually repealing them or gutting them so that the voters never get a chance to decide through representative democracy. Through direct access to democracy. This is what passes for representative democracy, and I'm putting that in massive scare quotes because obviously it's the opposite. Now, North Carolina, you just mentioned, also huge news out of North Carolina in the past several days. It looks like we found the voter fraud that Republicans were really worried about. Yeah. Oops, turns out they're the ones committing it?
Yes, that's exactly right.
What do we know?
So it's being called the biggest case of election fraud. And the fraud wasn't on the part of the voters. It was on the part of the candidate, potentially, and consultants who worked for him. So in North Carolina's 19th district, the election board in North Carolina has not certified the results. And people were wondering why. And it turns out, as journalists dig deeper, that a Republican operative who was working for the candidate who supposedly won, this Republican candidate Mark Harris, was paying people to quote-unquote harvest ballots. In effect, was paying people to collect absentee ballots and then could have tampered with them, could have faked the statistics. They're now looking into this person who's been who went to jail in the 90s for fraud. His name is Leslie McRae Dowless. And they found that historically on campaigns he has consulted on, something like 96 or 98% of the absentee ballots in that county went for the Republican candidate. So we're just at the beginning of uncovering what seems to be a very, very big scandal. And the supposed margin of victory for Mark Harris was only 905 votes. So in a close election like this, committing a crime like this can totally skew the results.
And meanwhile, maybe I missed it, but where's the outrage from all the Republicans who are so obsessed with voter fraud? Funny, it seems like crickets.
Right. There's basically been no reaction or response from the Trump administration, from Speaker Ryan, from local Republicans. In fact, Mark Harris, the Republican candidate, is denying any involvement in this and demanding that the votes be certified without answering for why this consultant did this or where this came from. So I think there's more to come. It's a story we'll be following closely.
Now, moving on to the tax front, we also have some news this week starting to help fill out the picture about what's happening in the wake of the Republican tax law that took effect earlier this year. One of the claims that we heard a lot from Trump and from Republicans championing the then bill that is now law was that it was going to result in an average pay increase of about $4,000. For middle-class workers. We know that hasn't materialized, and actually we've seen stagnant and even declining workers' wages in the wake of that law taking effect. But now we're starting to actually see some more evidence of what's happening on another front, another one of the sort of big promises we heard out of Trump and out of Republicans championing the tax law was that it was going to create all these jobs. Oh my God, was this a jobs bill? And what were companies going to do with this massive corporate tax cut that they were going to get handed? They were going to pass it on to their workers, not just through higher wages, but by creating new jobs. Jeremy, what are we now learning about whether that second promise it holds as much water as the first?
We're learning it was a lie.
Don't you love when I set you up like that?
Yeah, that's so much fun. So, of course, earlier this month or late last month, General Motors announced massive layoffs of 14,000 employees. They were not part of this coalition, but looking further into how companies have reacted in the year since these tax cuts passed, they found that most of the companies that advocated for the tax cuts and claimed they would boost jobs have actually laid off employees. The biggest advocate was what was called the Rate Coalition, the Reforming America's Taxes Equitably Coalition, who spent millions of dollars. It was basically a who's who of corporate America. And Think Progress, our colleague Josh Israel, reached out or looked into the employment practices of about half of these companies, and about half of them, or he looked into all of them, and at least half of them have had massive layoffs since the tax cut went into place.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Jeremy, but does that feel like the exact opposite of what they were claiming they were going to do with these tax cuts that they now have?
That would be right, Rebecca.
Sorry, I just wanted to get that clear there, right? The exact opposite of what they promised on jobs is what is actually happening now.
Yes. And keep in mind, it's not only in the wake of this tax cuts. It's in a supposed favorable economy where the unemployment rate is low, although a lot of people are still looking for work. People are waiting patiently for wages to finally start ticking up. But it's it's not a good economy. In a recession, it would be more understandable, you know, companies tighten belts. But the fact that in the wake of getting this giant corporate tax cut, they are pocketing it and then laying off employees suggests what happens when you cut corporate tax cuts and add new incentives for companies to have lower taxes overseas, which was a key part of the tax law.
Now, the number of times I feel that there has been what should have been the death knell for the case for trickle-down economics is more than I can count. It feels like this should be another one of those moments, and yet I can't say I feel optimistic. So I'm sure we'll still be having these conversations as we move forward in the weeks, months, and years ahead. But information to keep in mind as folks are assessing the credibility of the promises that were made about this tax law that remains the law of the land. So moving on to the minimum wage front, we also actually have two new studies out in just the past few days on the minimum wage, one of which tells us a lot about why we're seeing massive subversion of democracy by Republicans in state legislatures, like we were just talking about in Michigan. And that's a study from Pew telling us about what voters want when it comes to the minimum wage. Spoiler, it's that it should be higher.
Yes. Again, you spoiled it for me this time.
But I didn't give the like fun rub, right? It's not just that it should be higher.
So there was a survey of every state and how they view the minimum wage in their state. And in every single state, voters think that the minimum wage should be higher. And often it's, and this is in, you know, every state from Texas to Arkansas to, you know, typically blue states where the wage is higher, like California or New York. Every state, and it's an average of $2 higher, residents think the minimum wage is too low. And we see this time and time again when it's put to a vote, such as it was in many states this cycle, raising the minimum wage always passes overwhelmingly. And this is more evidence as to why states are having to subvert democracy or overturn local minimum wage ballot initiatives to stop their minimum wage from increasing. It's because they're incredibly popular.
So just to like clarify and sort of repeat, to repeat, because I feel like it's just so powerful, the finding here. In literally every state in this country, the state's residents believe that their state minimum wage should be higher than it is currently. Every state in this country, red, blue, purple alike. And there was another finding in this study that I also found fascinating that actually looked at the interaction between minimum wage policy and democracy. And that finding was that the gap between what a state's residents think the minimum wage should be and what it currently is smaller in states that have access to direct democracy, things like ballot measures. Compared with states where it's all representative democracy, and we were just talking about how well that works in places like Michigan, where we're watching leaders in that state's legislature not represent the wishes of the voters, but actually act to take away their access to making the decision. So a lot there that I think helps paint the picture of why we're watching this new playbook unfold, championed by Republicans in states across this country, but also backed by the National Restaurant Association, as we've talked about last week.
And I think it's just one more point on this. It's consistent with what we see time and time again, is that surveys of legislators and policymakers, we find that legislators always think that the interests of campaign donors and wealthy business interests is more aligned with voters than it really is. So we're seeing this massive disconnect between what voters think the minimum wage should be and what it actually is, partly because the people at the top are out of touch because they listen to their donors more than they're actually hearing from their voters or listening to their voters, at least.
Now, the other study out in the past several days on the minimum wage comes to us from the National Employment Law Project, our friends over at NELP, and it has to do with the fight for 15.
Yep. So they did a comprehensive study on the results of the fight for 15 and how much it has helped workers. And they found since 2012, which is kind of, I think, the apex of when the fight for 15 kicked off, it has resulted in $68 billion in raises for workers and helped 22 million low-wage workers throughout the country, and as a result, has massively reduced income inequality.
I have nothing more to say. It's awesome. It's amazing. It's amazing. Huge wins across the board where we've seen them. A lot more states continuing to try to follow suit. And also, this is exactly what Republicans in so many states and also the National Restaurant Association are afraid of, is wages continuing to go up and additional income in the hands of really hardworking folks that's having to come through their paychecks.
One more thing to add on that. That amount, $68 billion, is 14 times larger than the last raise workers got when the federal minimum wage was raised. And I think it lends some credence to the argument that the federal minimum wage should be raised to $15 now that we have a new Democratic Congress.
And yet it's been stuck for a decade because Republicans in Congress have not allowed that to be a serious conversation. And it shall be interesting to see if the Democratic House wants to force a vote on the minimum wage because it is so popular and would be a great opportunity to show a little bit of where Republicans in Congress stand and whose side they're on. So we're running out of time, Jeremy, because that's what we do well when we get together. But we would be remiss if we didn't mention a particularly horrific piece of news that broke on the immigration front, and that has to do with asylum.
Yeah. So asylum is the process. It's protected under international human rights law. It comes up a lot in the Trump administration and on this show, where people who are fleeing violence or human rights violations can enter the country legally. They are protected in international law. It's something that Trump has tried to undermine. Now the Trump administration, according to a report from BuzzFeed, is trying to charge people, refugees applying for asylum, trying to charge them a fee to get into the country. And they are trying, the amount is $50. And, you know, middle to upper income people may say, oh, what's $50 to have a new life? Well, if you're fleeing violence and don't have a lot of money, that could be a lot of money. Also, it could be a violation of human rights law because you're protected. Your entry into a country is protected. So to punish people and charge people money who are risking their lives is just the latest in a line of many horrific human rights abuses from the Trump administration.
So, Slevs, I feel like we need a piece of good news in here because of I don't want to end on that note. And I want to plug a couple of things that we're reading, but none of them are good news particularly.
So skip to the good news.
In the spirit of good news, that's exactly what I'm doing. That's literally what I'm doing. So skipping to the good news this week comes to us in the form of some of the selections that have been made for who's going to be in leadership in the new Democratic House.
Yeah, so the election was just last week for Democratic leadership. Of course, Nancy Pelosi was reelected. She still has to be voted on the House floor by the full chamber. But other folks who got into leadership, I think the most notable is Barbara Lee, who had originally run for Democratic caucus chair, but was then given a position overseeing the Democratic Steering and Policy Committee, which shapes the policy and the proposals for the next Congress. Representative Lee, of course, is one of the most stalwart champions of inequality issues and poverty issues in the Congress.
B. Lee, we love you. I'd love to have you back on the show to talk about your priorities heading into the next Congress, but just such a thrill to see her joining the leadership team and also joining Rosa DeLauro, Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, another stalwart champion, a fighter for working families and especially in the hunger space. So a hell of a team that is leading up that Democratic Steering and Policy Committee now. So in the last couple of minutes that we don't have, Jeremy, because we're so out of minutes.
Are we going to go back to bad news?
I feel like we would be remiss if we didn't, and I'm going to get this in as sort of part of what we're reading here, but we would be remiss if we didn't give folks a reminder that December 10th is the deadline for public comments for the public charge rule, which we know is a backdoor attack on our family-based immigration system. The what we're reading plug that I'll give here is a couple of friends of the show, Elena Hung, a co-founder of Little Lobbyists, and Catherine Perez, who is the executive director of the National Coalition for Latinxes with Disabilities, have a powerhouse fire emoji op-ed in the New York Times talking about public charge and in particular what the rule would mean for people with disabilities. So just a plug there, obviously links as always on our nerdy syllabus page, but wanted to fold that in with that friendly reminder for anyone who has not yet gotten their comments in. You can go to protectingimmigrantfamilies.org and everything is really easily laid out there, thanks to our friends at the Protecting Immigrant Families Coalition. So go ahead, get your thoughts in. The administration is legally obligated to read every single comment that they receive, so it really can make a difference, and don't miss your chance. Jeremy, do you have news you want to share?
Oh, is it on me?
I feel like it is. It's your news.
Well, I'll share it. Well, I guess I have one more episode left, unless I can find a way to come back. But I'll be leaving at the beginning of next year. I'm going to be going back to Capitol Hill to work for a new exciting member of Congress. I will miss the show and the listenership very much, but I'm excited to do some work working directly to implement these policies in the Democratic Congress.
I'm going to hold you to that because I'm sending you every bill we want your member to introduce, but I can't tell you how much we're going to miss you. And we'll do a goodbye party formally on this show when we're actually saying goodbye. So I'm not going to get emotional yet, but thought that folks could use a little bit of lead time to get emotionally prepared for the great loss that they are about to experience. So don't go away. More Off Kilter after the break, talking to Joel Berg about what we know on the Farm Bill deal and the ongoing threats to nutrition assistance that this administration is not letting up on, even though they have not gotten their way in Congress. Don't go away.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
You're listening to Off Kilter. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Food assistance in the U.S. has been in the GOP crosshairs since Trump and the current crop of congressional Republicans were sworn in last year. But is an end finally in sight? With a bipartisan farm bill deal reportedly in place in the Senate, the answer for now seems to be maybe. To get caught up, I'm thrilled to bring back Joel Berg, CEO of Hunger Free America, a good friend and a friend of the show. Joel, thanks so much for coming back on Off Kilter.
My pleasure.
So I wanted to have you back because there's some good news for a change, it seems. It's still a very much developing story, but it seems that there is a compromise on the Farm Bill, which listeners of this show will remember. This has been an active and live conversation for some time now in this Congress, with tremendous risks to the largest nutrition assistance program in this country, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as food stamps. And we're now hearing that the Senate appears to have struck a bipartisan deal that we're told, based on media reports, does not have the kinds of damaging proposals that House Republicans were trying to use this farm bill as an opportunity to sort of take a pound of flesh, a lot of pounds of flesh, out of the SNAP program. So bring us up to speed a little bit. What do we know so far?
As of today, December 5th, as best we know, there has been a compromise reached that basically deep sixes the massive cuts in SNAP proposed by the Republicans in the House. As you'll recall, the House, by just a few votes, passed a farm bill that would have taken away billions of dollars worth of food from millions of people. And it was a real bait and switch. They pitched it as, oh, we're just adding work requirements. But it was actually work reporting requirements without any real job creation money in it. And much of the money that was taken out of the program had nothing at all to do with work requirements. It was reducing the flexibility of governors to better utilize the SNAP program to help working families. And so much of the money the House Republicans were proposing, taking out of grocery carts, was actually coming from senior citizens, children, people with disabilities, veterans, and working people, not the able-bodied, strapping young men they claim just don't want to work.
Yeah, the Fox News image of the people who are being hurt.
The Senate bill neither added to SNAP nor cut snap. Now, some people were jubilant they did that. I'm a tough advocate, and I say any bill that doesn't move us down the road towards ending hunger ultimately is a failure, but this is far less of a failure than the failure that the House was proposing. So it is a victory of sorts. We prohibited probably something truly awful from happening. That being said, virtually no one has seen the language. I don't know that the language is actually completed. And you know, in this town, D.C., where we are, you know, the meaning of every syllable is vital. And so we don't believe it till we see it. You know, they could have, you know, 300 pages of verbiage. And if a decimal point's in the wrong place or a semicolon's in the wrong place, that could mean a few million people are going without food. But as best we know, the massive cuts have been defeated for now.
So potentially a large victory that I'm going to call it that. I think your point is taken that if we're not talking about actually increasing access to nutrition assistance or other kinds of bigger think policies that are really going to make a dent in hunger, this isn't a win in the sense of really moving the needle, but it is a huge aversion of what could have been truly, truly damaging policy that would have dismantled food stamps.
Yes, and the election was critical as well. We're all nonpartisan here, but the fact of the matter is it was House Republicans who were pushing these cuts. Some of the people pushing them, like John Faso of the Hudson River Valley of New York, made it a campaign issue.
He actually ran on taking food away from people.
Yes, using very, very, very racist imagery and implying that everyone getting SNAP was a substance abuser. They had pictures in front of liquor stores. Absolutely outrageous when you can't use SNAP at a liquor store. And he lost. You know, Congressman Dan Donovan of Staten Island, my hometown of New York City, personally promised me and many other people working on this issue that he'd vote against cuts and voted for them, and he lost. And so many of the people pushing for cuts lost their jobs, and that side is not going to be in the majority in January. So assuming this compromise does hold, and I think even if the House Republicans try reneging on the deal, there's no way the Senate's going to go along with this in the next few weeks, then at least for the next 2 years, when Democrats have the House of Representatives, you're not going to see major cuts in SNAP, I suspect. But it's also unclear whether they're going to physically be able to get this done in the next few weeks. The mechanics of governing, print a bill, have it so-called, as we wonk say, scored by the Congressional Budget Office, which in human talk means giving a cost to the bill, having the exact same bill passed by both the House of Representatives and the Senate, and then signed by the President of the United States, when we never know on any given minute what he's going to do. So it's still open question, even if the compromise holds, whether they're actually able to pull this off and pass a bill, and whether the House rejects the so-called Hastert rule that the Republicans have had, that they needed a majority of Republicans to support this. In my judgment, it's more likely for the bill to pass the House if they discard that rule. And assuming there are no SNAP cuts, you'd probably get as many, if not more, Democratic votes for this farm bill than from the Republican side.
And for contrast, just to sort of remind people where we were before and what happened in the House when they took up their version of the farm bill, which would have taken food assistance away from some 2 million Americans and in 1 million households, not a single Democrat in the House voted for that bill. And actually, Republicans lost about a dozen of their own caucus. That is how draconian this proposal was,
well,
and
were
how controversial
votes.
It was.
The first vote lost by 2 votes because they are pissed off about something else. And then on the second vote, a few dozen Republicans voted against it. But a number of those votes against it were because the cuts weren't draconian enough. Now, in the Senate, a good third, not a single Democrat in the Senate voted for cuts, but a third of Republicans in the Senate did vote against cuts in SNAP, partially because they opposed cuts in SNAP and partially because they really, really, really wanted to pass a farm bill for the agricultural constituents, including those getting corporate welfare. And they were smart enough, some of the senators, to know that if they included massive SNAP cuts, it was just a non-starter in the Senate. So for whatever reason, the Senate bill was far more moderate, and even more Republicans were supporting the position that we should have no major cuts in nutrition assistance.
Now, part of the reason I'm glad you brought up the election, and I want to stay here for just a minute before we move on to the next piece of this
conversation. We can celebrate a little in our nonpartisan way.
Yeah, well, and also you're having to be nonpartisan. I mean, this show is a project of the Center for American Progress Action Fund, which does get to have a little bit of space. But
okay, then I can take a break from my role as CEO of Hunger Free America, and the next 5 seconds will be me as a private citizen not representing my nonpartisan, non-political organization, and my private citizen answer would be, woo-hee, we kicked their you-know-whats.
As your lawyer, I'm really thrilled with all those caveats,
That's
Joel.
Right. For anyone recording this, I guess this is being recorded, but the IRS, I'm very careful, about that.
Our legal team will be so pleased.
Yes.
But I'm glad you brought up the election, actually, because I feel like it's often sort of treated as just conventional wisdom that Social Security and Medicare are the so-called third rails of American politics. People know across party lines that if you talk about cutting those programs, you've got real political consequences that are potentially going to be brought to bear. Now, does that always stop Republicans from proposing to cut these programs? Definitely not. We see it happen all the time. But it is something that I think people understand that across party lines, Americans love these programs and don't want to see them cut.
And it's popular among some people on the far left, as some on the far right, to say there's no difference between the two parties. And that's just ridiculous. We're not talking about the environment today, but an old boss of mine, I ran two campaigns for, Congressman Frank Pallone, is most likely going to be chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee over the environment. He has 100% voting record from the League of Environmental Voters. He's replacing a Republican, I think, who has like an 8 or 9% voting record. You see people like our friend Jim McGovern, one of the greatest anti-hunger champions in the country, is going to be chair of the House Rules Committee. And so you just look at not only environment, but issues like poverty. The Democrats are by no means perfect, and I'm always going to keep pushing them, but to have this false equivalency, they're the same, when, as you said, every single Democrat in the House of Representatives, even the most conservative one, even the one representing blue dog districts or swing districts, voted against SNAP cuts. Every single Democrat in the Senate, including arguably the most conservative ones like Joe Manchin, voted against SNAP cuts. So there really are some core bedrock beliefs that are uniting both sides. And frankly, never has there been a clearer distinction between the two parties at any point in American history. Because, 40 years ago, there used to be truly liberal Republicans like Jake Javits, from New York, and truly, 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 right-wing, Democrats from the South, like Jamie Whitten, who was a segregationist. Now, those seats are Republican in the South and Democratic in the North. So I reject the whole no labels thing, because, labels actually help you understand whether a bottle has poison or nutrients in it.
Well, and part of the reason that's a hell of a way to put it, Joel. But part of the reason that I bring this up is because I think that, as much as that conventional wisdom may be there when it comes to Social Security and Medicare, and I think some people have started to group Medicaid with those programs after it sort of became clear how popular Medicaid is, right? When it was Medicaid that saved the Affordable Care Act in a lot of ways during the healthcare fight. But I think a thing that people haven't really ever viewed in those terms is SNAP and its popularity, right? And we can look at polling. CAP itself has done polling, finding that 2/3 of Americans oppose cuts to nutrition assistance, and that cuts across party lines. It's not just Democrats. It's people. It's humans in this country who don't want to see this program cut.
And having criticized conservatives, I will say there are a number of Democrats who voted for SNAP cuts, I presume because they wanted to keep their seats. One was Claire McCaskill. She was the only Democrat in the Senate a few years ago to vote for an amendment authored by Jeff Sessions to slash SNAP. Blanche Lincoln in Arkansas, Mary Landrieu in Louisiana, a former Democratic senator from North Carolina, all voted for SNAP cuts. They were in swing states, and they lost anyway. And I would argue that standing up for principles is not only the right thing to do morally, but smart politics. Even in the most agriculturally dependent congressional districts in the country, take a heavily agriculture district in Iowa or Kansas, more people in those districts are getting SNAP benefits, food stamps benefits, than getting agriculture subsidies. And so it's just a wrong conventional wisdom, and sometimes even Democratic political consultants, who are overwhelmingly, I must say, upper middle class white men, or more than upper middle class, wealthy white men, telling Democratic candidates, stay away from this. You'll think you're too much for poor people, or by implication, non-white people, even though most SNAP recipients are white. It's just wrong morally, but it's also wrong politics. The people who attack SNAP, many of them lost, and people even in swing districts who stood up for SNAP, like Antonio Delgado, the Democratic candidate who won against FASO, he stood up for SNAP, not apologetically, and he won. So it's mistaken politically and morally to say you're going to advance your political career on the backs of poor people.
Now, and at the same time, I think another conventional wisdom on the flip side, even among Democrats, has been that it's impossible to argue against the conservative proposal of so-called work requirements, which, as you were describing before, has nothing to do with helping anyone work. It's actually bureaucratic red tape to try to take benefits away from people dressed up in the language of work. So cuts in disguise. But I think what we saw here, and here you were, you know, we're talking about every Democrat in the House voting against this bill because they knew it was about taking food out of the mouths of American families. Is that logic changing? And are people starting to wake up to the fact that Americans don't want to see those kinds of policies?
Perhaps, but also people knew it was a bait and switch and knew it was hypocritical. The Republicans just lavished massive, you know, tax cuts on the wealthiest. I do think progressives need to be clear, we're not against work. And the people we represent, low-income people, they want living wage jobs more than everyone. And so I don't think our counter should be always, oh, we're against work requirements. Our counter would be, we're for living wage jobs. And the people who receive SNAP want living wage jobs. So if you're serious about work, let's raise the minimum wage. If you're serious about work, let's have a jobs program. If you're serious about work, let's really bring broadband into rural America, so rural America can enter more so the information economy. So I think we have to be careful not giving the false impression we or the people we represent are against work, but the other side isn't really for work. They're for punishing people with the fake veneer of being for work. We're for real jobs that pay real wages, and we would be thrilled if able-bodied people no longer need SNAP for themselves and their families because they earned enough to feed their families.
So now, pivoting away from Congress for a moment, so
Oh, thank goodness.
Right. And I wish we could do that in more than a metaphorical way. But hey, they're still here. So it's great potentially that we might have this deal in place. We'll see more as the language comes out. We'll have a better sense of exactly what this deal does. But assuming that we are actually potentially moving past the Farm Bill conversation as where we see Republicans trying to cut nutrition assistance in this country, we don't really get to get the balloons out yet because there are other threats on the horizon, literally materializing as we are speaking, that also attack nutrition assistance but aren't getting any attention.
Yes, they are trying in the Trump administration to issue either regulations or rules or guidance to the states, making it more difficult for able-bodied adults to continue to receive these benefits. As I know you've discussed in the past, there's an attack on immigrants, legal immigrants, the ability to get food and housing and health care help. But let's also keep in mind, in the best economy in decades, 40 million Americans suffer from food insecurity. That's a wonkish term, meaning 40 million Americans struggling against hunger. That's bigger than the population of Texas and New England combined. And it's far higher than before the recession. So I'm on a tear now telling anyone who's going to listen, and many people won't, we cannot accept mass deprivations as any sort of new normal just because our political system is screwed up. That doesn't mean we accept this. It means we change the political system. If we were here 40 years ago talking about marriage equity, and I was the head of Freedom to Marry, and well, given this political environment, the best we can have is civil unions, I'd say poppycock. We are going to mobilize the people most affected, convince people in the middle, and then take away credibility from our opponents to build the movement necessary to make this happen. As you know, Rebecca, we're the only industrialized Western country on the planet that has this level of poverty, that has this level of deep poverty, that has this level of hunger, that has this level of homelessness. It's horrible for our economy. It's horrible for international competitiveness. It destroys our moral fabric. It's absolutely unnecessary. If everyone just listened to 50 policy prescriptions, you and I could walk off in a row, we could end this problem immediately. It's entirely about political will, and we don't need to accept the politics of today as the politics of forever.
Now, for anyone who has ever heard the sort of old conservative trope that Democrats or progressives are just against proposals, we're not for anything, right? That often gets said in the poverty context. It's, oh, you know, here we are opposing these proposals to change the safety net. Well, obviously, we're opposing cuts that take food out of people's mouths, but it's also not that we're just against things. We have a whole agenda of things that we are for, and you're actually one of those people who's been the architect of a lot of those types of policy proposals, especially in the hunger space. If we were having the national conversation around hunger that you wish we were having, what would it look like?
Number one, we would make housing more affordable. The top cause of hunger in America now is people can't afford housing and food. Two, we'd have a national minimum wage indexed to inflation. Three, we'd have a national jobs program that really guaranteed jobs for everyone, but really understand the unique problems of impoverished communities, urban, rural, and suburban impoverished communities. And then specifically on the hunger side, we would dramatically increase the SNAP program, the food stamps program. I've proposed combining access to SNAP with combining access to every other nutrition and anti-poverty program, dramatically reducing bureaucracy, which the Republicans say they're for, and allowing people to apply on a smartphone and manage their benefits on the smartphone. And then I'd make universal school meals free for every kid in public schools. I played very, very mediocre suburban JV soccer. It won't shock you to know I did better on the public speaking team than on the soccer team. And yet my suburban school district gave me a free jersey, regardless of my family income, because they said a free jersey is important because sports is an integral part of your schooling. Why in the world we don't think that way when it comes to food? And we have this massive bureaucracy to distinguish between kids who are very poor and they get free meals, sort of poor, and they get reduced price meals and not quite poor, and they have supposed full price meals, but that's subsidized by the government, is crazy. We could save billions of dollars at the school district level, at the state level, on the national level, if we got rid of all those ridiculous categories, got rid of all that ridiculous paperwork, and just said when you show up to school in your first period classroom, you get a full nutritious a meal. You do all those things I've ticked off, it would cost tens of billions of dollars, but as CAPS previously reported, this was years ago, we all need to update this, but a few years ago, CAP found that hunger costs our society $167.5 billion a year. $167.5 billion dollars a year, because hungry children don't learn, hungry workers don't work, hungry senior citizens don't stay independent. And so if we could fix this problem for, let's say, $50 billion, and it costs us $167 billion. If you owned a house and there's a hole in your roof and a handy woman or a handy man came to you and said, I can fix that hole in your roof for $50 and I know it's costing you $167 a year, wouldn't you take the deal? Of course you would take the deal, and that's the deal we should take in hunger. It will save our country far more than it would ever cost us to solve this problem. I met with a delegation of people from overseas, I won't mention the country, and I explained this to them. They were just flabbergasted that we didn't do this. And then I explained, but you understand the seas are rising, we're doing nothing about global warming. This has nothing to do with whether we know what works. Another thing I'd say, as CAP and the off-kilter broadcast is aware, that there are people paid a lot of money to lie about natural science and to sow the belief there's confusion or dissent within the scientific community about what causes global warming, what will solve global warming. What people don't understand, there's an army of people paid a few blocks from here, some people we know very well, who are paid to basically lie about social science and basically paid to say, we don't know what causes poverty. Goodness forbid, we couldn't possibly understand what to... We know what causes poverty. People don't earn enough for all their expenses. Next. And we know what solves it. Give people more money to pay for their expenses or reduce the cost of stuff.
I love it. It's the Ariana Grande treatment, right, of policy issues. Thank you. Next, right?
wait till my video comes out, although I hope Pete Davidson doesn't screw it up. That's my one and only pop reference of the last decade.
I will savor it. I will savor it for a while. And for anyone who's hearing this and still thinking, yeah, but I mean, all those things do cost money, even if they save it in the long run. I find I have very little patience, if any, left for any of that kind of thinking in the wake of this tax law, given that the tax cuts that Republicans just gave to just the top 1%, I'm not talking about the overall something close to $2 trillion in tax cuts, just the tax cuts for the top 1% themselves actually cost more than the entire SNAP program, right? So just to put that in perspective, I think we've got a little bit of space if we think differently on how we spend.
Yeah, absolutely. The average SNAP benefit's about $1.40 per meal. I once asked Senator Bozeman Ryan, a Republican senator from Arkansas, who strongly supported work requirements for SNAP, whether he would support work requirements for landowners who get farm subsidies, that they may not actually work on the land. He said he didn't understand the question. And I repeated the question. He said he still didn't understand the question. The hypocrisy of micro-focusing on the small percentage of the SNAP caseload who get a microscopically small allotment of $1.40 per meal when ignoring people getting millions and millions and millions of corporate welfare really is stomach churning. Now, I believe in an opportunity for all society and a responsibility for all, you know, society. I believe that able-bodied people who can work should work. And you know who else believes that? Able-bodied low-income people. So this is a whole false diversionary debate. A lot of it is imbued with race baiting and the false belief that the people getting help are overwhelmingly non-white when the largest number of people are white. But I hope that at least House Republicans having gotten a shellacking and hopefully Senate Republicans seeing that states like Pennsylvania and Colorado are electing progressive candidates understand that they either need to moderate or become extinct.
In the last minute or so that I have with you, and I think it has to be a minute because I've already gotten hand signals that we're talking for too long, but Joel, it's hard not to talk to you for a long time.
It's hard for me not to talk to me a long time.
I don't even know why I'm here, right? But Paul Ryan, soon-to-be former speaker Paul Ryan, is on his way out.
He's a jolly unhelpful fellow. He's a jolly unhelpful fellow. He shafted poor people for decades. Don't let the door of the house hit you on your way out. That's my retirement party for him.
I don't know why I would say anything else. I bring it up because on his way out, there are so many folks in the mainstream media who are yet again giving him this sort of legacy hue that it's about him as a poverty warrior.
It's ridiculous.
What
as
is
you
your
know.
Message to these people?
Paul Ryan's proposals all would take food and money away from poor people. The idea that we're going to solve hunger by taking away food from hungry people makes about as much sense as saying we're going to solve drought by taking away water from people. It makes no sense at all. And it shows you the class bias among the media elites. If there was someone who claimed to be an environmentalist, but their top policy prescriptions were opening more coal-fired plants, no one in the media would say they're environmentalist. That's the poverty equivalent of what Paul Ryan's been proposing, taking away food from hungry people, and only because editors and unfortunately too many reporters spend no time in the trenches actually talking to people in poverty, actually learning about these issues, could they even vaguely think about buying his party line that he's an anti-poverty warrior. If Paul Ryan's an anti-poverty warrior, I am quiet and unassuming. And dear listeners, I'm not.
I love that you felt the need to clarify that because, Joel, I think your point stands.
You can't quite see my aggravated facial expressions on a podcast. Trust me, dear listeners, I have a face for radio and a voice for mime.
Joel Berg is the CEO of Hunger Free America. He comes back generously on this show to give us updates when there's updates in the hunger space. Joel, thank you so much for coming back and for always
thank you. And
fun.
I still think you should name the show On Kilter. I think everyone else is off kilter.
We'll take it under advisement.
Don't go away. More Off Kilter after the break. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrel from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Off Kilter. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Opportunity zones. Listeners of the show may have heard the term, but what exactly are they? A promising new bipartisan strategy for attracting private investment into poor communities? Or a giant new tax break for wealthy corporations in disguise? To break down the good, the bad, and the ugly of ozones, I am pleased to be joined by Benga Ajalore and Rajani Frederick, two experts at the Center for American Progress. Thanks to you both for joining the show.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
So I think before we get into any of the sort of timely conversations and some of the reasons that Opportunity Zones are getting attention in the past couple of weeks, I want to take a big step back because I will confess I don't know a ton in this space and about Opportunity Zones. And I bet a lot of other people who care about poverty, care about inequality, might not know a ton either because it's kind of one of those Washington labels that you slap on something that actually is somewhat complex. So, Benga, I'm going to start with you. Help us understand what are these opportunity zones? What is in current law right now?
So what's in current law and what was actually part of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act is a program to have capital gains that are sitting kind of on the sidelines, as they say, going into distressed communities to fund a lot of programs, housing, to help increase the number of jobs and to reduce poverty.
Now, and Rajani, to bring you in to sort of add to this, this sounds like a really good thing, right? And so some people might be listening and going, wait a second, was there something really great on poverty buried in this tax law that almost universally has been panned on the left because it's just about Robin Hood in reverse? Is this something that we should be viewing as some kind of, you know, really good anti-poverty success that the Trump administration just brought about?
Well, it certainly been marketed as a great poverty alleviation initiative. I think as Benga just outlined, you know, the initiative, and I have to emphasize this, you know, it was passed as a part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, which I need to remind our listeners was passed in the dead of night last December. It was passed by all Republicans. And so something that's passed in the dead of night when many people are sleeping, that typically is a red flag, right? I know that what a lot of advocates and a lot of folks who are really learning about this initiative and has been a part of the process all along would really tell you is that there's nothing currently within the structure of the initiative that would really ensure that it does alleviate poverty in the way that it says it does. And that is part of the conversation that Benga and I have been really involved in, which is it says that it's here to alleviate distressed low-income communities by giving the revenue and giving money that allows it to get access to resources and opportunities that communities have long been cut off of. But again, a bill or a law that doesn't specify community involvement wasn't made in many ways with community at the table should always give someone pause. And so, you know, as with any poverty alleviation work, it's really hard. It has to be really intentional, and it needs to be very specific. And those are just things that we have not seen in the initiative.
So, Benga, help us dig in a little bit here, right? It's being marketed as this innovative, market-driven thing that's all about using tax breaks to attract private investment into under-resourced communities. I mean, all of that sounds really good on its face, and people might be hearing Rajani say, you know, we should have some caution as we look at this, and they might be going, yeah, but like, really, why? And what do we know so far that gives us any level of caution? What are the critiques that you're hearing, and actually you're part of leveling them too?
I think one of the things that we want to mention is that this plan, the Opportunity Zone, actually started out as the Investing in Opportunity Act that was co-sponsored by Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey and Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina. And that was to kind of push the, you know, poverty alleviation by bringing in capital to go to some green projects. Then what happened was with the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, it was kind of snuck in there. And then some of the original, like, reporting requirements, some performance metrics that were part of the bill were all stripped out. And that kind of action brings up concern. The second concern is that when you talk about money going into distressed communities, the first thought is always gentrification with displacement, because you're thinking, okay, these people are going to buy up low value housing, tear it down, put in luxury condos, because that's going to get the highest return. And so if you don't put in the guardrails, all that capital that's coming in, all those capital gains, all those funds that are coming in is looking for the highest return. And the highest return is not educational services. It's not health services. It's not fixing food deserts. It's about housing. It's about maybe certain businesses that are going to have the highest return. And so what the concern that we have and the concern that the community has is that the projects that are going to be funded are not the projects that the community want.
And Rajani, that's actually a lot of the work you've done over your time at the Center for American Progress is looking at, like, how could we do this well? So if this isn't quite what we would do, is this something, now that it is in current law, that's fixable? Are there changes that people are proposing to try to put in those kinds of guardrails? And is this is there a path to making this something that could actually be a tool for good?
I mean, that's certainly the conversation now that we are having and that folks all across the country are having. You know, there are over 8,700 designated opportunity zone communities, and it spans the gamut of rural communities that are located in you know, in North Dakota, South Dakota, to urban areas that are located in Washington, D.C. There was an article that Benga and I just recently released that really talked about the opportunity zones in Crystal City, Virginia, and Long Island City, New York. And we ended up doing this column that really highlighted the fact that the area where Amazon's second headquarters is being located is located nearby opportunity zones. And so calling into...
That's all the time we had for this interview this week, but you can find the full conversation on the podcast version of Off Kilter anywhere podcasts are found. And that does it for this week's episode of Off Kilter, powered by the Center for American Progress Action Fund. I'm your host, Rebecca Vallis. The show is produced by Will Urquhart and David Ballard. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Off Kilter Show, and you can find us on the airwaves on the Progressive Voices Network and the We Act Radio Network, or anytime as a podcast on iTunes. See you next week.
I want freedom. Freedom. But it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the mouth. We just trying to get freedom.